Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the South Bay Show. And today is a special program all about the Beach Cities Symphony. And we're lucky enough to have the music director, Barry Brisk, with us. Sorry, I'm a little bit confused. Barry Brisk, conductor and music director of the Beach City Symphony Orchestra, first conducted in public at the age of 14, when he performed selections from South Pacific at his graduation from Webster Junior High School in West Los Angeles. As a student, he also conducted the orchestras at University High School, Mount St. Mary's College, and the University of Music, formerly Academy of Music, in Vienna, Austria, where he studied with the prominent conductor-teacher Hans Swarovski. Professionally, Brisk has conducted many orchestras in Southern California as well as in Mexico and Austria. Maestro Brisk has been music director of the Beach City Symphony since 1994 and is particularly proud of having expanded the orchestra's repertoire. He has conducted works by more than 80 composers, more than a dozen of whom are living. And today we're going to talk about the concert coming up this coming Friday, and November 4th. And we're not talking about living composers at this point, but we are talking about the composers that really get people excited, and I think especially young people, about classical music. Joseph Haydn, Symphony No. 1 in D major, Johannes Brahms, Variations on a Theme by Haydn, very interesting, Opus 56A, and call the mad genius of the piano concerto, Sergei Rachmaninoff, Piano Concerto No. 3 with, is it Jorge?
Or Georgie.
Georgie, right. Slavchev,
Georgie Slavchev, right.
Georgie Slavchev, the soloist. Well, Barry Brisk, welcome to the program today.
Oh, thank you, Joe. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
It's one of the great pleasures, Barry, that I have, that we get to feature the Beach City Symphony. So we have to start with the elephant in the room, because most people will say, the Beach City Symphony? We have a symphony? I didn't know.
Barry, well, it's been around for 67 years in the Beach Cities area.
Yes.
So it's just the nature of things that it's, you know, at the community level as opposed to the level of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, which has a huge budget for advertising. It's just hard to get the word out. But we've been there for 67 years.
But it is still, and you must get this, whenever you meet someone new and you tell them what you do, they must say, many of them say, really? I didn't know.
Yes, that's a famous response that we get. There's really not much we can do about that. As I said, it's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
Because we can't afford ads in the Los Angeles Times or the Daily Breeze or something like that. We just have our own little inner circle things, and we do various outreach things, but that's the way it is with all community orchestras, actually.
You and I have been doing this program prior to performances, what, 3-4 years?
Something like that, yes.
And it's been one of my great joys is when I talk to people that actually have listened to our program. We actually have a program on Wednesdays sponsored by the Redondo Beach Chamber, on Fridays by the Manhattan Beach Chamber. And many of the people that know those programs have heard this Beach City Symphony, and we always get very, very high praise for just highlighting the symphony, and really it's a wonderful venue, the Marseille Auditorium at El Camino College. The cost of parking is $3, and that's the most money you have to spend, because the concerts are free. The Beach Cities concerts are free, although there are some wonderful raffles and there are refreshments. It's really free if you want to bring out the whole family. You can bring 2 people or 20, and everyone can get in for a very reasonable price. You just have to pay for parking. It's wonderful. We are having a fantastic concert coming up, Haydn, Brahms, and Rachmaninoff. I really was excited about this, Barry, because it's back to besides Mozart, these are among the best known conductors in the pantheon of conductors for classical music. Why these composers?
Well, excuse me. First, I've been wanting to do the Rachmaninoff for a long time, but it's a particularly difficult concerto. And I've known Georgi Slavchev for a long time. He played the Brahms Second Concerto with us 7 years ago, something like that. And so if he could play that one, I knew he could play the Rachmaninoff Third. So somewhere like a year and a half or 2 years ago, I suggested it to him, and he really liked the idea. So he spent the intervening time learning it. He hadn't really studied it before, but now he's got it down. So that was the Rachmaninoff. Now, normally on a symphony concert, the symphony, whatever you're doing, comes after the intermission, and you have typically an overture and a concerto before the intermission. Well, the Rachmaninoff Third Piano Concerto is as long as many symphonies. It's like 40 minutes long. So I decided to do that after the intermission in place of the big symphony, because that's as big as a big symphony.
Yeah.
So that gave me the opportunity before the intermission to do 2 smaller pieces that we probably wouldn't do or have trouble fitting in. In other words, the Brahms Haydn variations are just a little bit too big to be an overture. And the Haydn First Symphony is rather on the small side, so just sort of squeezing that in somewhere would seem a little unusual. So I just took the advantage of this slightly different programming schedule to fit in works that you don't normally get too much.
Well, they're both very, very comforting and familiar and beautiful, and it's I know everyone is going to have a great time this coming Friday. Tell us what's been going on in the world of the Beach City Symphony since we last spoke. Has there been any changes or news of note?
Not particularly. I mean, there's always some slight changes in personnel. Some people move away or retire, and then you get some new people to come in, and someone who used to be with you but left 10 years ago has moved back to the neighborhood, so they join you. So little things of that nature. But in general, things are just going along as usual, which is what you can hope for.
Right. So we have these pieces. I was able to acquire the music. I would love to set up. Let's just go in order. Set up Haydn's First Symphony. What is most striking to you about this piece?
Well, there's more of a story to it than just that. Haydn is famous for having written 104 symphonies. Number 104 is played a great deal, the most of any of his symphonies, and usually the last 12 or so, which are referred to as the London symphonies because he wrote them to be performed in London, are the ones that are played more often. Oh, his number 88 is fairly well known, and his 55, which has a famous title, the Farewell Symphony, gets played on occasion. But the very early ones you never hear. Oh, they're all recorded, of course, but you almost never hear them on concert. The Symphony No. 1, which was written approximately 1759, when he was like 36 years old or 37, it's questionable whether that's really his first symphony, because people didn't bother writing down that kind of detail. He definitely wrote it, but whether he wrote Second Symphony or the Fourth Symphony before this one is something, you know, the musicologists don't know for sure and probably never will.
Hmm.
It's just one of those things. We have it, and it exists in a couple of versions, but it wasn't clearly dated. But we know it was written around 1759.
Hmm.
And it is decided that it's been actually, that it is by him. It fits stylistically.
Mm-hmm.
It's written for a small orchestra, the full string section, of course, with two oboes, two horns, and a bassoon. So it's not like his later pieces, which would have flutes and French horns and trumpets and timpani. So that stuff is not there, which is
mm-hmm.
typical for this period. Adding on those instruments happened as the symphony developed over the years. It's a rather short piece, only 11 minutes long,
mm-hmm.
Because 100 years later, you know, you were getting huge symphonies. You know, by 1859, you already had the Beethoven Ninth Symphony and, you know, Mendelssohn symphonies and Schubert symphonies and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But it only has three movements, a fast movement, a slow movement, and a fast movement. And you get something which you don't have too often in the Viennese symphonies of the early period, what they call a Mannheim crescendo. So Mannheim is, of course, a city in southern Germany. Crescendo is the Italian word which means to gradually get louder. It used to be that music was either soft or loud. The idea of getting louder or getting softer hadn't occurred yet. So this orchestra in Mannheim under Stamitz, I think it was Carl Stamitz, developed this concept of gradually getting louder. So that's why it's called the Mannheim crescendo. And this symphony begins with that. So, I mean, it's not an enormous crescendo because it's a small orchestra, but it definitely starts softly and builds up rather quickly in five measures to a louder spot. So that's one of the unique things here. And other than that, it's a typically charming thing by Haydn, by an early Haydn. I mean, at this point, as I said, he was something like 37 years old. He lived to 1809, which puts him at close to 80. I can't think that fast. He was born in 1732.
Mm.
So he was in his upper 70s when he passed away. So this is a relatively early work. And he wrote it while he was working for a Mortzin in the, I'm guessing, Bohemian city of Dolny Lugovic.
Mm.
So, yeah, people usually think of him working for Esterhazy, but who was Hungarian, but this is before that period.
Well, this is an amazing example. I mean, as you said, stylistically, you can hear that it is Haydn. It's a beautiful piece, and we don't know if it's his first or second or third symphony, but it's called Symphony Number 1, yes?
Exactly.
That's wonderful. Well, let's hear a bit of it. Ladies and gentlemen, Joseph Haydn Symphony Number 1 in D major.
Thank you.
So that was the first movement, yes.
Right. And as you could tell, that's a rather short movement. What was that, 3 or 3.5 minutes long? Whereas his symphony 104, written some 50 years later, is much lengthier and has more material to it. But this is the beginning of the symphony as a form. So it started out, you know, with slightly less material, which is fine. Everything has to develop.
Right. Now, where would you place, if you can, where would you say most music historians place Haydn in the pantheon of great composers?
Oh, he's one of the top ones,
yeah.
You know, Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms. Usually they don't get into the 20th century when they make the pantheon, but,
yeah.
You know, there were great composers from the 20th century, Stravinsky, Bartok, and whatnot.
Right.
But yeah, he's definitely up there with them.
Okay, yeah. It's just so iconic, and he had this, as you said, it's in the style, what is it about Haydn's style that we recognize, do you think?
Well, it's very lively.
Yeah.
That's putting a very sort of a lightweight answer to the question. You get used to various turns of melody. He doesn't sound like Beethoven or Bach at all. He does things differently. His harmonic progressions are different. The way he structures a phrase is different from the others. They all had their own, shall we say, fingerprint.
Mm.
And so you can tell Haydn from Brahms, from Schumann, from, you know, somebody else very easily once you're familiar with the whole thing. If you only know a couple of pieces, then it's
right.
not going to be obvious to you. But once you've heard a great deal of classical music from the 18th and 19th centuries, then it becomes perfectly clear if you're hearing something by Schumann or something by Tchaikovsky or something by Haydn.
Right. Wonderful. And we're gonna talk about our next composer in a moment, but I just want to make sure that people understand this is an opportunity to share classical music, the genius but also the privilege of classical music with everybody you know. You literally can invite your whole block, or schools can invite a class. Do you think you have enough space for a class?
Oh, yes. Barcy Auditorium is very large. It holds, just downstairs, at least 1,200 or 1,400 people. So
right.
we can accommodate all kinds of people.
Right. But lately, though, I don't think I was at the last concert, but the concert before, it was very full. I mean, there are times when the word is out and all of these meetup groups start showing up.
Oh, yes, we are hooked into one of these meetup situations. I personally don't handle that, but it does happen. And, of course, some of those people who came for a meetup situation, they just saw the program and they found the dates for the next concerts, and now they've become regulars. They're not
right.
coming as part of a meetup group. They're just coming to enjoy the concerts.
Right. It's a volunteer orchestra, Beach Cities Symphony. There are two S's in the middle, yes. BeachCitiesSymphony.org. And, of course, it's a volunteer symphony, and also you do take donations.
Oh, what? Nonprofit organization doesn't take donations. Without donations, we couldn't exist.
Absolutely.
Because there are expenses involved, you know.
Absolutely.
So we have to have donations, whether they're corporate or foundations or individuals.
Right.
You know, we get a lot of individual contributions, and also it's probably too late but when you get to the concert, there's this very nice program book, and various people or companies have purchased ads in the program book. Well, that's also a fundraiser for us. So if somebody wanted to do that in the future, that would be another way to help us gain some money. You don't have to advertise an organization or a business. You don't have to say, you know, Sam's clothing store, but some people just write a thing and say, congratulations to the Beach Symphony's orchestra on the occasion of their 67th season.
Right.
And you buy an ad with just something like that, and that's a way of making a contribution. But the booklet is already organized for this upcoming concert because it's in 4 days.
Right, of course. But you would just call the number there's general information, inquiry at beachcitysymphony.org.
Right, that's where you can find out everything.
Or you can, if you have musical questions, you can write to music director at beachcitysymphony.org, and you can get information from Barry directly, or you could send an email to concertmaster@beachcitysymphony.org. And then should people do people mostly do email or do they phone? Because there are two.
Oh, I don't think anybody phones anymore. No. It's usually email. But most of the questions anybody has are answered on the website. What the dates are for the whole season, the programming for the whole season, pictures of what's upcoming, pictures from last year. Everything is right there. So once every 2 years, I might get an email from somebody outside of the orchestra, you know.
Yeah. It's the 67th season, and it's the 2016-2017 season. This is the first concert of the season. And then, of course, the next concert is January 27th, 2017. And this is it's Le Grand Guest?
Yes. Well, we put titles on all of these concerts, but... Yeah. That has to do with, you know, some traditional kind of music we're doing on that concert, yes.
That one is a very, very familiar names for concert goers, Mozart, Beethoven, and Sibelius.
Right. But why don't we save that until, excuse me, until we get to January?
We will. Right. We will. Go to the website if you're interested in the future future schedule. And so let's talk about Brahms. Where did Brahms live and work?
Well, he was born in Hamburg, Germany, which is up on the north part of Germany in the North Sea, which today is one of the largest cities in the in Germany, and it also one of the most important trade centers because there's a huge port which ships or receives things from all over the world. He actually spent most of his life in Vienna. He came there as a fairly young man looking for opportunity, and I guess he found them because he stayed there. He was also a very brilliant pianist, and he toured playing his own works. And even before he moved to Vienna, he accompanied a violinist, Remini, and who was Hungarian. When he was like 18 years old, he was this man's accompanist, and that's what gave him the impetus to write his Hungarian dances, because he got into the style of that by accompanying Remini, you know, when they played together. And he was a very, how should I say this, serious composer. You don't find any sort of lighthearted, flippant things. You know, and this may have been because when he was very young, he was championed by Robert Schumann, who was very famous at the time. And Schumann supposedly made the comment, "Hats off, gentlemen, a genius." Well, when somebody as famous as Schumann calls you a genius, at least Brahms felt that he had to do serious things. So no longer do you get Hungarian dances, which are light and fluffy. Yeah. Now you get heavy symphonies and concertos and choral music with either biblical texts or else some other solemn kind of a thing. So whereas Beethoven is occasionally lighthearted, and Haydn's symphonies sometimes are very actually funny, the things he does there and how he repeats or doesn't repeat a phrase can be very amusing, not Brahms. It's all very serious. It's wonderfully done, but it's all very serious.
Now, Hamburg is right at the sort of the I don't know if it's the headwaters of the Elbe. Is that true?
The Elbe. That's right. That goes down through the east side of Germany. Right.
Right. And I don't know about Hamburg, but I know the far eastern side of Germany is a city called Dresden. And I just spoke to some travelers from Dresden, and people wonder about Germany in many cases. Dresden is such a new cosmopolitan city. It's a very young city, not because it wasn't old to begin with, but because in World War II, it was hammered. Dresden.
Oh, that's correct. It's a very, by German or Western European standards, it's a very old city. But at the very end of the war, the military approach was they weren't surrendering. Well, that was Hitler was,
right.
You know, evil. He should have just surrendered, and he would
right.
have saved a lot of people and a lot of stuff. But he didn't. So basically, we flattened it.
Right. Right.
Same thing happened in Hamburg, by the way, and so. It has been rebuilt, of course, since that 70 years ago.
Right.
But the downtown has been rebuilt following the blueprints of the old days. I mean, we're not using old-fashioned construction. It's
right.
all done with modern construction, but it's made to look it's old.
I'm fascinated by this. Dresden was the capital, or is the capital, of the Eastern German state of Saxony. It was this person was telling me that the old town of Dresden was reconstructed like as people remembered it before, and you know, with the documents they have, and it's just amazing to think of a 1740s town being reconstructed.
Right. Well, Dresden is actually much older than the 1740s.
Oh, yeah,
this probably
yeah.
goes back 1,000 years. But yes,
yeah.
they reconstructed it. But that's not the only city in Germany. Leipzig did that. Munich did that. In Poland, Warsaw was heavily damaged, and the center of that city is made to look like it used to look. And you get all kinds of smaller places where when they were rebuilding, they wanted it to look like it used to look. Then you
yeah.
get out into the suburbs, and everything's modern.
Yeah.
You know, so but yeah, it's happened in more than one city in Europe that they've done that sort of thing.
Fascinating, fascinating. Would love to. I'm especially drawn to Dresden and certainly Hamburg, and then of course one of the jewels of Europe is Prague, because
oh yeah, that's a marvelous place.
Because it was never bombed. And so it's
it was
still
a little too far to the east. The same
yeah.
thing happened with Paris,
yes.
because Paris capitulated.
Yes.
France capitulated, so they were never bombed. That's why it has that utterly charming look. It didn't need to be rebuilt. It is, of course, naturally, over the years, you have to reinforce walls and things like that. But it was not brought down by the war.
Right.
So it has all kinds of older stuff that's utterly you know, marvelous to look at and enjoy when you're there.
Right, right. Wonderful, fascinating. Now, again, when did Brahms get the idea of doing? It's essentially a cover tune. It's not exactly a cover of a Haydn piece, but variations on a theme. What
right.
drove him to do this?
Somebody introduced him. Somebody who worked at a music library found this thing. It's called the Chorale St. Anthony.
Mm.
And this little bit of a thing. And they thought it might have been written by Haydn. So we're talking about Haydn's now long dead.
Mm.
So they thought it might have been written by him. But we're not 100% sure.
Mm.
But back in the old days where, you know, today, recognizing who wrote what or who created what when, whether we're talking about the internet or some new software or something, we know exactly who made it, what day, what year. Back then, things were a little vague.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if you had a nice little piece, oh, this Chorale St. Anthony was for like a woodwind quintet. Well, if the publisher wanted to sell it and it was just written by some Mr. X, they might have put Haydn's name on it because they're all dead, and that way it'll sell better.
Right.
So we don't know for sure who wrote the theme. It's also been credited with a not-quite-so-famous composer, Ignaz Pleyel, who, by the way, later went on in Paris to open a piano factory and made lovely pianos in the middle of the 19th century. So he may have written this theme, but Brahms liked it, and decided to write a set of variations on it. This was in 1873. He was in Bavaria at the time,
right,
in a little town called Tutzing, which is an hour's drive or so outside of Munich. And I bother to mention that little thing because a good friend of mine lived in Tutzing for many years, and I stayed with him a few times. Okay, so much for the personal there.
And it's fun to say, Tutzing.
Tutzing, right. It's cute. Not impossible to pronounce, but it's a cute-sounding name. So Haydn wrote this thing, and he wrote it in two versions. You'll notice that it was referred to as Opus 56A. But he has a second version that he wrote at the same time for two pianos, and that's referred to as Opus 56B. That almost never gets done because you don't find performances with two pianos very often. And it's so famous as an orchestra piece, there's sort of really no reason to do it that way. But he did write and publish a version for two pianos. So it starts out with the theme, and then it has eight variations. And as you do in variations, each one contrasts the previous one. If there's a quicker variation, then there's a slower variation. If there was one in a major key, the next one's in a minor key. Maybe you go, and instead of a 3-4 variation, you have a 6-8 variation. So that keeps it all fresh. And after the eight, there's a theme, eight variations, and then the finale. And the whole thing is maybe 19 minutes long or so. So that's why I was able to combine the Haydn Symphony with the Brahms as a slightly different kind of a first half of the concert. And admittedly, since the Brahms piece has the name Haydn in the title, that sort of gave me the idea to do a Haydn symphony with it, even though the two pieces are not related.
Now, where is it? Is there a natural break in this? We want to highlight this variations on a theme by
right.
Haydn.
Everything lasts a couple of minutes. I mean, the theme will last maybe 3 minutes. The first variation will last 3 minutes, but there's a stop after
Ooh.
Each one. So if we come to a conclusion, you can just stop it right there.
Okay. Well, I haven't listened to the whole thing, so let's try Johannes Brahms' Variations on a Theme by Haydn, Opus 56A. Here we go. Thank you. All right there. I think that was two variations, yes?
Right. We had the theme and two variations there. And what's interesting, the theme only has wind instruments playing. There's no strings. Because, of course, the theme that we have, this supposedly Haydn theme, was for a group of wind instruments.
Mm-hmm.
So his first big contrast after the theme, when in the first variation, is to bring in the string section.
Right.
So that's one way he built the contrast, by using a different different orchestration, you know, different sets of instruments. And the first variation is also faster than the theme was.
Right.
You know, so just to give you a little concept of what goes through a composer's mind when they're doing things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, beautiful piece, very, very interesting, and looking forward to that. And I'm going to do a station break really quickly. For ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the South Bay Show, and we're talking classical music here with music director Barry Brisk of the Beach City Symphony. And it's just wonderful to have a volunteer orchestra in our area here in the South Bay. And if you didn't know, you should become aware that we have a volunteer symphony right here in the South Bay of Los Angeles. You can find out more at beachcitiessymphony.org. Yes, there are two S's in the middle, beachcitiessymphony.org. And, of course, we have they have a concert coming up this coming Friday, November 4th. The concert begins at 8:15, but I believe, Barry, you're going to have a talk at 7:30?
Correct. I do a pre-concert lecture at 7:30, right.
Excellent. So if you come early, and also parking is $3. If you have three $1 bills, it's very convenient. Then you can park, and there's a machine, and you get the ticket, and you put it in your dash, and you're good to go. Right at El Camino College, and we're talking the Marseille Auditorium. Very, very convenient. And now that brings us to Rachmaninoff. Tell us a little bit about Sergei Rachmaninoff.
Well, he was obviously a Russian composer who was born in 1873. He, when the revolution came, he was, I think, already out of the country in 1917, and he stayed out. I don't believe he ever went back. And he became a U.S. citizen, and he lived in our neighborhood, sort of, Beverly Hills. And he died there in March of 1943. He's a very romantic composer, and even though he lived halfway into the 20th century, he still remained a romantic composer. He did not get into what we would think of as modern music at all, which is fine because he was born definitely in the romantic era. You know, he was born while Tchaikovsky was alive and Brahms was alive and Rimsky-Korsakov and all of those people.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote this concerto in 1909. His second piano concerto, which is also extremely famous, was written in the 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting story there, he was having a mental block, or a, sort of like, you know, writer's block kind of a thing. And he went to a doctor, I don't know if he was a psychiatrist or what we had back then, but he was basically given sort of like hypnotherapy. And that sort of loosened him up. And he composed the second concerto, and after that, I guess he didn't have such problems. And he dedicated the second concerto to this Dr. Dahl, I believe was his name. But then in 1909, he composed the third concerto while living or spending time in his country estate in Ivanovka. He did not have the opportunity to really practice the concerto at the time while he was in Russia because he was going to the United States for a tour. So in those days, we didn't have electric keyboards or anything like that, but professional pianists had a practice keyboard. Mm-hmm. It was the size of a full keyboard from a grand piano, and the keys had the same action, but they weren't hooked to any strings. So you could just sort of carry this thing with you, because people had long voyages to make. You know, there were no airplanes back then.
Right.
So to get from Russia to New York, this meant first a long train ride of a couple of days, and then 6 or 7 days crossing the Atlantic by ship. Well, you had to practice. So they had these practice keyboards, and that's where basically he learned the piece, that is to play the notes of the piece.
Yeah.
Now, particularly interesting was when he got to New York, he performed this piece twice, once with the New York Symphony Society, conducted by Walter Damrosch, a very prominent American conductor and musician of the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, several weeks later, he had a second performance, conducted by a different person, conducted by Gustav Mahler, who at that time was music director of what's now the New York Philharmonic. And he really enjoyed working with Mahler. Now, once you know the music of Mahler, it's hard to think of him in the same breath as Rachmaninoff. Their music is just so utterly different. But he was very conscientious and rehearsed them over and over again. And to quote Rachmaninoff himself, according to Mahler, every detail of the score was important. Though the rehearsal was scheduled to end at 12:30, we played and played far beyond this hour, and when Mahler announced that the first movement would be rehearsed again, I expected some protest or scene from the musicians, but I did not notice a single sign of annoyance. The orchestra played the first movement again with perhaps even closer appreciation than the first time.
Mm.
Of course, that can't happen today. There were no unions back then. And so if you have a 2.5 hour rehearsal, you have a 2.5 hour rehearsal and you have to end it. You know, but life was a little bit different, you know, 106 or 7 years ago. So he was very happy with that situation of working with Mahler. You know, the piece was published the following year, and Rachmaninoff referred to the third as the most favorite of his own concertos, saying because he preferred the third because the second is so uncomfortable to play. Now, what's interesting is most people, pianists, consider the second concerto to be much easier than third. The third is a real mountain to climb, but the second is just normally difficult.
Mm.
You know, so it's interesting what happens. Now, let me go into thing. The concerto, it says, was really both respected and feared by pianists.
Yeah.
It's dedicated to the famous pianist Joseph Hoffmann, but he never publicly performed it, saying, quote, it wasn't for him.
Mm.
Okay, but the American pianist, Gary Graffman, lamented that he had not learned this concerto as a student when he was still too young to know fear. As a young man, you know, you'd have gone after it to say, hey, let's go for this. But when you're 40 years old, you say, oh, God, that's hard. I'm not going to do that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's just various reactions we've had to that.
Now,
our soloist, as we mentioned earlier, is Georgi Slavchev, who lives in the West Los Angeles area. He's performed the Brahms second concerto with us a few years ago, and he's a wonderful pianist and a very nice person, and he has a command of this thing that you wouldn't believe. I mean, you can practically see the smoke rising from the keyboard as he plays some of these difficult passages. So, so, you know, it's a real pleasure to be working with him again.
Georgi Slavchev.
Chev. It's a V at the end.
Georgi Slavchev.
Right.
Georgi Slavchev. Well, I have to say, you know, as we talked about this piece before the show, there's a mad genius quality about the Rachmaninoff third. It's just there's something about it. And you notice in the first 2 minutes that this is not going to be any ordinary experience. And you said, isn't there a movie? And there is. It is The Shine. It's just called Shine. And it
all
was,
right.
1996.
Yeah, right. I knew this was about 20 years ago, yes.
Yeah, it's a recounting of the Australian pianist David Helfgott. Helfgott.
Helfgott, right, a very German name. Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Who suffered a mental breakdown.
Right. I think he suffered the breakdown maybe even before he played this, but for about one season or so, he went around and played this with a few orchestras, and we've never heard of him since then, unfortunately. Very talented man, but he just had a mental issue.
Well, he was offered a scholarship to the Royal College of Music in London, which is very prestigious. But David's father forbade him to go. But I guess the encouragement of someone else in his life pushed him, and he said, "Okay, I'm going to London." He entered a concerto competition, and it almost killed him. He chose to play Rachmaninoff's Third, and he'd attempted to do it as a child. I'm kind of reading and paraphrasing, but he struggled. He overcame. He practiced incessantly, and apparently he won the competition, but he suffered a mental breakdown and ended up in a psychiatric hospital and received electric shock therapy, all as a result of winning this this darn competition. That's what music can do for you.
Well, I think he was kind of a special case.
Maybe.
Most people going to competitions, if they're too nervous, they simply get cold feet and drop out, you know. So,
when you rate piano concertos in terms of difficulty, where does this one, Rachmaninoff's Third, lie?
Well, of the standard concertos that you get from Mozart through Rachmaninoff and Shostakovich and things like that, there are three that are the outstandingly difficult ones, and those are the two concertos by Brahms and the third Rachmaninoff. They are the real mountains to climb, as an expression I used a few minutes ago. But they, you know, if somebody can really play those, they've really arrived. You don't. There are many pianists who don't play those things, and you don't have to. You can do perfectly well with other things, but those are the ones that are extraordinarily difficult to pull off.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the movie is Shine, headlined by Jeffrey Rush. Noah Taylor, Armand Mueller, John Gielgud, Lynn Redgrave. It's worthy of your attention, the movie. And, of course, let's hear the music. We have about 4 minutes left, and I want to make sure we at least get the first 2 minutes in because they are amazing. Here we go. Rachmaninoff's Third Concerto. I have to leave it there. I just want to say thank you so much for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure being with you, Joe.
It's a wonderful thing to have the Beach City Symphony here in our neck of the woods, and we love having them, and we look forward to this coming Friday. We hope everyone will join us. BeachCitySymphony.org. Come on out and have a wonderful time at the symphony. Thank you very much, Barry. We'll see you there.
Excellent.
All right, that's our show, ladies and gentlemen. Have a wonderful day, and happy Halloween to everyone. Bye-bye.